Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 18th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Daryl Trimue. Today's session number is 3 and is titled Economic Ethics. He Ain't Heavy and He Ain't My Brother. Let's listen in.
My name is Daryl Trimue, and this session deals with economic ethics. And I'm happy to be here. It is part of the heritage of Holden to acknowledge that we are somewhat the beneficiaries of the mining company that built most of these structures here, as well as taking a lot of the mineable metals out of yonder mountain. So that, to a certain extent, we are the beneficiaries of a capitalist endeavor. And without getting back completely into ecological ethics, we also are the beneficiaries of the responsibility of tidying up the earth from the tailings and such from that capitalist adventure, because we now have the responsibility of the care of the earth in this village. Well, he ain't heavy, and he ain't my brother, is kind of the title I've had here. You know the old song, He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, in which there's a celebration of a bonding between people, of a recognition of mutuality, and a certain denial of the problems of being so bonded, of carrying the load of another. I'd like to share with you two passages of scripture, and in your times of quiet, I'd like you to meditate on both. They're both here, they're in the same Bible. The Bible, to me, is not univocal, but has several voices. One voice in terms of God, but several messages. The first passage is from Matthew 5, the 38th verses through the 42nd verse. You have heard that it was said, eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Well, now that's from Matthew, and recorded as the teachings of Jesus Christ. The second one is from 2 Thessalonians, part of the epistles of Paul, the third chapter, the sixth through the 13th verses. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, we command you, brothers, to keep away from every brother who is idle and does not live according to the teaching you received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example. We were not idle when we were with you, nor do we eat anyone's food without paying for it. On the contrary, we worked night and day, laboring and toiling so that we would not be a burden to any of you. We did this not because we do not have a right to such help, but in order to make ourselves a model for you to follow. For even when we were with you, we gave you this rule: if a man will not work, he shall not eat. We hear that some among you are idle. They are not busy. They are busybodies. Such people we command and urge in the Lord Jesus Christ to settle down and earn the bread they eat. And as for you, brothers, never tire of doing what is right. Well, two passages, one Bible. Okay. Is there a contradiction or is there a tension? What I'd like to suggest to you is that there is a tension rather than a contradiction. And I hope I'm doing this not simply because I want to harmonize the Bible and make it less confusing, but rather because I think there genuinely is a tension. You will note certain kinds of concepts I've put on this board here, the first being need on one side and merit on the other. If you think about Christianity, it is predicated upon the primary distributive principle of need. Jesus dies for us not because we deserve it, because he saves us while we are yet dead in our sins. We don't merit salvation. We don't merit grace. Indeed, grace is a concept in which it's almost the antithesis of merit. You get a generosity, a forgiveness, a love from God precisely because you don't merit it. And that's why it is indeed mercy and grace. Now, if you think about that, that is essentially the way Christianity functions. Human beings in need of grace, in need of forgiveness, not human beings meriting it. That is the rejection of kind of works righteousness for which Lutherans are famously noted, and rightfully so. And yet, if we think about the distributive principles of our society, you can think back to realize that it is not based upon need, but at least in terms of the mythos, that is the worldview, that is the ethos of our society, it is based upon the notion of merit. Indeed, in the famous play, Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller, the point that Willie Loman really cannot get is that his value to his company, to his manager, was based upon him being the best drummer available. And now that he's gotten older and he's slacked off, he has become expendable. So when he complains to his manager, you know, a man is not an orange, you just can't eat all the pulp and throw away the rind, he meets puzzlement with his manager because that's exactly the model that he understands in terms of good management. That as long as you're juicy, productive, you have a place in the enterprise. And indeed, you know, when you lack that, business efficiency requires that you be eliminated. Well, he ain't heavy and he ain't my brother, tries to tap into the current debate as to what are the mutual obligations we owe each other. You have notions of charity or philanthropy and notions of systemic social redistribution. I'm not sure what most Americans realize, but rather that our laws of taxes and other certain kinds of laws all require certain levels of social redistribution. Some of you are old enough to remember the Great Depression. Now, my father lived through that. And you had a lot less government. And a lot of people talk now that a lot less government is better. Of course, you know, that's not my father's recollection. And that, in fact, is not even in terms of quantitative data, the reality of this country, because a lot of people simply lived and died in poverty. And indeed, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected to four terms in part because that New Deal represented a way out for a lot of Americans, black, white, and others, of the kind of morass that we were involved in. Well, I want to open this up to a discussion of everyone, but I want to bring you to another set of concepts: sustainability and flourishing. And here's where I think we can kind of get back to those scriptures. You'll notice that Jesus did not say, you know, construct a society in which every single need of everybody, including every desire, is met by you, and be willing to sacrifice to that extent. Okay? But now that first passage is talking about sustainability, about basic things like food and clothing. And when we talk about the notion of Jubilee, the 50-year celebration which we will have next year, that is kind of an institution in a theocratic state in which, because of the nature of human beings to generate wealth and for other people to be less apt at that, to have on a periodic basis a reorganization of society, a redistribution of wealth by excusing debt, by perhaps reconnecting land to families and generations where people had perhaps for a variety of reasons not handled their affairs well or met misfortune in terms of drought, famine, or war and lost the ancestral estates. On the other side here, we have flourishing. Now, we all know what flourishing is, and I think I've gravitated towards flourishing. Okay? I want to do more than just live. I want to do more than just go from paycheck to paycheck. I'm not ashamed to admit that. I think that is the desire of most people. And when we see the passage in 2 Thessalonians, I think what Paul is saying here is, hey, I'm a tent maker and an evangelist. I work at both occupations. Idleness is not a virtue, it is a vice. And I think what Paul was also trying to do was to correct a certain kind of misinterpretation of his teachings with regarding to the second coming, the parousia. You know, if Jesus is coming again only momentarily, why be industrious? Well, what he's saying is, yes, we expect Jesus shortly, but we don't sit around waiting and letting other people attend to us while we are waiting. So I think, again, it's a tension. We don't let people starve to death while we have the ability to help them. On the other hand, we don't try and reward people who are idle when there is work available. But notice how I put that, when there is work available. Then we have another issue here, work versus careers. And here I have to be somewhat autobiographical to try and give you an idea. In my own ancestry, my ancestors were not, I'm like 7th, 8th, or 9th generation American. My ancestors came over here in the early 17th century and worked steadily. A lot of it for other people. But after 1865, primarily for ourselves in one fashion or another. And it took several generations for my family to move anywhere from sustainability to flourishing. Now, frankly, my family never lived on welfare. Technically, my father's family and my mother's family never lived on welfare. They lived in poverty. Okay, see, there's a difference. You know, they were what you would call the genteel and meritorious poor. And my grandfather during the Great Depression, when there was no work, he was a mechanic and even had a mechanic shop, had to shoot pull, didn't have enough cars to repair, and had to hustle a little bit. My grandmother had a little still, and between them, they somehow pulled my family through, a lot of it by doing things like shipping my father to my great-grandfather who had a farm, so that at least he could eat and they could feed the rest of the children where they were. And of course, my father benefited from World War II, as did my mother, in which finally he was able to get some education. He wasn't killed in the war, since I'm a baby boomer post-war. And my mother, a sharecropper's daughter, was able finally to get off that farm, to get out of shares, not because anyone was generous or Christian or anything else, but simply because the war required Rosie the Riveter and had to have women in factories. And from that, she finally could use the high school education that she got, marry my father, who had a little bit better education, and therefore move us from sustainability to flourishing. What I'd like you to do, and then I'd like to kind of open it up for greater discussion, is to think about what kind of country we are in which it takes 8 or 9 generations of people who work steadily to move beyond mere sustainability to flourishing. And what do we need to do to make that process more equitable, in which if people want to work, that they can in fact find a reasonable opportunity for jobs. And if they do have some incentives to work and some ability, they can move more rapidly than 8 or 9 generations from sustainability to flourishing. And I think we also have to be fairly sanguine about the future. I am a beneficiary of a certain development in our society in which college education, for instance, became relatively inexpensive in the late 60s, and I got to go to college. And now we find, of course, that college education is now moving out of the realm of the middle class altogether and going back to almost 19th century conditions in which it was simply the sole province of the wealthy. We should also be sanguine about the fact that 1 out of 5 children in this country lives in poverty. In my state of Texas, 1 out of 4 children live in poverty. In terms of the African American community, at least 40 to 50% of African American teenagers are routinely unemployed or underemployed. And in fact, our cities, for instance, the city I grew up in, Newark, New Jersey, are becoming increasingly dysfunctional in terms of serving as places of employment. When I was a boy in Newark, and I'll close on this, we had 7 or 8 operating breweries. We had foundries. With an 8th to 12th grade education, you could get a job, you could raise a family, you could own a home, and you could really actually move a little bit from sustainability even to some low level of flourishing. That is absolutely not true anymore, in which Newark is now run by prudential, metropolitan life, universities, and other information society-oriented industries, in which a high school diploma provides you no entree, and in which, in fact, a college or some sort of technical education is a bare requirement for any kind of employment. So we've, and I'm not saying we should go, and I don't think we can go back to an industrial society. What I am suggesting is that we have to be more intentional about how our country operates in the new information age, and about what access there is towards improving yourself for all members of our society. And it seems to me when we do that without creating a utopia, then we are faithful to this Christian call, and I'm Calvinist, to the Calvinist notion of transforming society, of Christians being active in society, to have government and industries in society have some sort of level of concern with actual realized justice. And you've been patient, and thank you, because I'd like to open it up and discuss this and perhaps even hear some of your ideas and stories about this and what you think is right and what you think is wrong. I see education as a conversation, so if you'll sit there, don't talk, we're dead. Yes.
Just in terms of education, because I seem to be having lots of discussions with people around here who are teachers, and that is a major piece that affects our children, obviously, and it is really a key to providing people with access to other choices. And certainly talking to people from California, Oregon, and Washington, money's tight, class size is high, social problems, maybe different, very, very difficult in some areas in terms of kids coming into the classroom. And I don't know the solutions. All I know is that we have a lot of kids who are not prepared in any way, shape, or form, you know, emotionally, spiritually, cognitively, ready to face the challenges that are going to meet them, or be able to step into jobs in the information age. Certainly, I've worked in bilingual education for all my career, so I've worked with a lot of Spanish-speaking children who happen to be poor and come from families that haven't had the opportunity for education. So I see education as a major part, and I feel sad and frustrated and maybe not brilliant enough to figure out some solutions. Because it's a scary situation, I think, we're in with thousands of children coming through the school system and not prepared in so many ways. And certainly in public schools, we don't prepare them spiritually. And I'm not, you know, making any, I'm not saying, you know, well, prayer in the schools or something is a solution, but we don't prepare them spiritually. And it's difficult to prepare them emotionally and but intellectually. It's a struggle. And maybe I feel it more coming from California than people in Oregon or Washington or Minnesota. But it's a struggle.
Yes, ma'am, I believe you're right. Can't argue with you there. It's a struggle. I think education is a key, and particularly some levels of equality of education. I'm the product of the Newark public school system, and I was fortunate. I was born at the right time. I got out of high school in the late 60s. The year after I got out of high school, the Newark Teachers Union went on strike for over a year. So, which means that people who were behind me lost a year's schooling. I was fortunate. When I went to college, I didn't really struggle in college. I had a very good education. And because the school system at that time still worked. My children now go to public schools. I had a colleague of mine, I teach at a university, and I think they wanted more diversity at one of the very fancy private educational institutions, and said, look, you know, I've noticed your daughter's very bright. How about, since I'm on the committee that gives scholarships, how about if you folks, you know, would you consider having her go there with a full scholarship to one of the premier private colleges, private schools in the area. And I thanked them profusely and said, you know, continue to look for diversity, but that's not for me, because again, in terms of my understanding of Christian duty, you know, Christians are to be involved in our society, including having our children involved in it. I also knew that the scholarship would not provide for private riding lessons and sailboating lessons and vacations in the Swiss Alps for my daughter. And a lot of her schoolmates had access to such interesting enterprises. I felt that the public school system was very good for her. Now, I don't want to carry that too far in the sense of saying that private schools are bad, public schools are good, you know, shun private schools. And put all of your children in public schools. I think that's unrealistic. But what I am saying is that we must, as you have pointed out, pay attention to our public education, because that's where the great masses are going to be educated, who work and think and are going to be our citizens. And, you know, I try and be active. My wife teaches in public school, and I try and be active in the public school system. My daughter also got a very good education. But I have to admit, it goes back to the fact that my wife and I are educated. My father and mother were educated, you know. So that there's a certain kind of accumulation of ability that inures to people through generations. And, of course, that... You know, that's troublesome if your parents are not educated, and even more importantly, do not value education. Mm-hmm. Do not see the connection between education and career, rather than just simply a low level of education and a daily job. Mm-hmm. But there was another person over here.
Well, Yeah, I think, you know, education certainly is important, but I think this is a many-pronged effort. People need to reclaim their families. Parents need to reclaim their children. People need to reclaim their neighborhoods and say, we won't tolerate this junk anymore. Churches need to be vitally active in providing communities for people to feel valued. So there's just a whole bunch of things that need to be done. There isn't any one simple answer. You just mentioned about parents valuing education, and this isn't even a racial thing. In the Midwest, in Moline, you have parents who don't read, so their kids say, well, my parents are getting by, why do I need to learn to read, this type of thing? And this is not a racial thing. It's, you know, across racial lines.
Yeah, the tragedy of that is that the jobs their parents have that didn't require a lot of reading, of course, being phased out and will not be available to them. The fact that their parents were illiterate or literate but didn't really value education is not going to help them at all. In fact, if they're not careful, it's going to condemn them to a life their parents never had. They're going to have downward mobility rather than even staying at the level they're at. Yes.
I was just going to say one more thing.
Okay,
plus the abuse of substances. You know, when you have parents that are doing it, you know, how are the kids going to, you know?
Well, yeah. And government cannot compensate for that. Yes.
I was going to say, I'm a middle school counselor in a public school in Arizona. And a month ago, I attended a conference that was partially funded by the federal government and the School to Work Initiative. And what they're trying to do throughout the country in public schools is make a plan that's comprehensive and systematic in preparing kids to know that what they're doing in seventh and eighth grade in algebra and in English and all of those are things that they need in order to work when they're done with whatever level of education they plan to go for. And the thing that I found very kind of interesting is that when you look at the pie of what people do to work as adults, the percentage of people who need a college education to work with the whole thing has remained at 20%. But the number of people who need trained skills in order to work has exploded, you know. So I mean, what we need to do is help our kids know that they need training.
Sure.
And so what we're trying to do is begin at seventh and eighth grade level, where we work to help kids begin to make a plan then.
Oh, that makes good sense. I think. Yeah. Yes.
It has been my observation that we live in a society which has increasingly defined knowledge in technical terms, and that's ignoring the fact that in the whole spectrum of people, you have different kinds. I don't want to call it different kinds of intellect, but perhaps different kinds of skills. And we lived for a number of years in Alaska, where I worked for the Department of Interior, and helped administer what was the last homestead program in the country. And it was amazing and quite enlightening to see the kinds of people that were attracted by that. And because you saw people whose call it their technical abilities, their ability to go out and deal with computers, computerized machinery and finance and all the kinds of things that we're putting a premium on today, it was very low. But at the same time, they had very high traditional skills of the American frontier. There was a couple with two small children, one fairly almost, you know, like had been born months before they showed up, and one who was about two. They lived the whole winter in Solana, Alaska, in a wall tent, like the one that stands out in the street. And that was the year when it hit 30 below at Thanksgiving and did not get above that until the end of February. and got as low in that area as 55 and 60 below zero. And tell me that they weren't skilled, that they didn't have abilities. But in terms of dealing with the technical and legalistic world around them, they were lost.
Yeah.
And we, as we progress technically, we are leaving those kinds of skills just out in the cold. And somehow we're going to have to be more intentional about providing opportunities for those kinds of skills, as well as call it the intellectual skills that go into the technical society.
Okay, that makes good sense. Yes, and then just over.
Something that we've observed in our children as they've entered adulthood, and one has finished her education and the other is still in process but took some time out, is entering the job market. Companies don't hire, just come and work for us. You go to a temp serve and you work for the temp service. And maybe they hire you, maybe they don't. And it seems like there's something that's really changing out there in how people get those entry-level jobs. And our daughter discovered that, I think she was making $8 an hour, and the temp service was being paid $22 an hour by this company to hire her. And why? I mean, what's in it? There's something in it for that company, obviously, whether it's flexibility or they avoid paying health benefits, or but something is going on there, and it just puzzles me. There's a change happening that I can't get my fingers on.
Sure. Well, yeah, I think there is a change, and a lot of it has to do with our society. I mean, I gave a little presentation on environmental ethics, and one of the people said, well, gee, you know, if you're really that concerned about energy consumption, you shouldn't come all the way up here from Fort Worth, Texas, because you used up either a lot of gas or a lot of fuel to do that. And you know, the man was right on one level. On another level, we live in a society which, I mean, my grandfather, even my father, you got a skill, and you worked basically from one employer or yourself your whole life. You never lived more than about 25 miles outside of where you were born. And, you know, you never worried about being adaptable, about retraining, retooling, reskilling, about having a flexible industrial philosophy in which to stay with a company you would be willing to handle different types of problems. I mean, that was not that kind of world, but that's the kind of world we live in now, in which for you to find your way in a career, whether it's technical or what we say white collar professional, you have to be willing to go from job to job, parts of the country, and sacrifice a lot of the things that our even near ancestors did not have to sacrifice. This gentleman over here has been patient.
I'm about your age, and so I grew up in California and went to arguably one of the best state universities in the country that, you know, was built up between the time of World War II and,
sure,
and the middle 60s. Had the benefit of public education and a public high school that probably, you know, has not been the same quality in that state since that time. And yet, you know, on the other, so I mean, there are plenty of things one can point to about gloom and doom. You know, probably in the 60s, California was fifth in per capita student spending in public education. This year, I think we're 43rd. And there are all kinds of these gloomy statistics that one could come up with, which are true, and maybe
go ahead, I'm sorry, okay. Just got out of there.
I mean, I don't argue with that, but on the other hand, I think rather than getting extremely depressed about all this, I think things can be changed. And while not a lot has already changed, one can see things that have happened. Like, for example, this past summer, the California State budget included enough money to drop the class size for in grades 1 to 3 from 30 down to 20.
Hmm.
I mean, and this, you know, having lived there a long time, looking at the political atmosphere, you know, somebody would have asked me 6 months ago, could this happen? You know, and I would say, well, this is about as probable as the Berlin Wall falling. I mean, it wasn't going to happen. But it actually
did. It did too.
Yeah. They don't have the money to build the school, so it's a catch 22. You can't blow a you got kids, where are you going to put them?
It may collapse in the details, but nonetheless, the funds to pay the teachers are there. The classrooms, yes, certainly don't exist. But nonetheless, some school districts that have space and can find teachers will do that. A lot of others will just be unable to. The only point is that things can change. In this case, it happens, you know, nobody thought the state economy would revive enough to generate that much tax money.
Sure.
But when it happened, something good actually did come out of it. So, I mean, you can argue, well, you know, it's luck or whatever, but the fate of economics or whatever, but nonetheless, things can change. They can be made better. We're not irrevocably on, you know, on a fast skid to...
Well, I see your hand, and I'll be right with you, but I wanted to interject something a little bit more pointed and perhaps into the conversation. When you drive by the highway and you see signs of "We'll work for food," or when you're in a downtown area and you run into a panhandler, mendicant, I guess is the perhaps nicer word, you know, what does that generate in you in terms of feelings? Do you assume that this person is, you know, some sort of sociopath, alcohol or drug dependent? Do you assume that this person has forms of mental illness? Do you guess that perhaps this person is lazy and doesn't want to work? And as a Christian, what do you feel are your moral obligations to this person, either on an individual level or on a societal level? But I'm going to throw that out, and while we think about that, I'm going to have this gentleman say something.
Well, I agree with you, and I agree with this gentleman over here. There are some things that we can do about it. But as I'm sitting here listening to people talk, I'm also a baby boomer, and I work in the healthcare field, and I know what the job situation is like. When people come in, they're getting $8 an hour, but the company's being reimbursed $25 an hour. As I look at sustainability and flourishing, I fight this pessimism in myself. Sustainability and flourishing could also be relabeled as lower class, upper class, the way I see it. And I see our society elapsing into something back in the 19th century out of Europe in the class system. You have the workers and you have the upper class. That.
Well, hasn't that always been true here, though?
What's that?
Hasn't that always been true here, though?
Well, you were talking about the middle class. And what I see as the difference between the United States and 19th century Europe is the middle class.
Okay.
Now, there was a middle class in 19th century Europe, for sure. But they were more controlled by the upper class. The colonization and the growth of the United States, we saw a dynamic working middle class that is, I see, sort of collapsing on itself and not doing anything to correct the education system, which is kind of the hallmark. I mean, what society, you know, the hallmark of any society is how you educate. And if you have a government that doesn't want to educate society, then pretty much breaks into a two-class system, I guess it's kind of like, I mean...
I see your point. Okay.
If nobody else...
Well, we just want to give everybody a shot, but yeah. Go ahead.
I'll tread on very thin ice and point out that an increasing amount of analysis draws the distinction not between upper class and lower class in our society, but between elder class and younger class. We are the first society in I believe the history of the world where wealth has flowed from from the younger, those are for whom education is becoming scarcer, to the older, those for whom perhaps the medical system is being predicated. And the session I attended in Washington this spring on Congress, that issue was discussed again and again and again, that as the care of an aging population under current scenarios gets more and more expensive, there is going to be less and less societal attention paid to bringing its younger people online. And quite frankly, the politicians that we met with considered that an insoluble political problem because the younger people don't vote. Kids in high school don't vote.
The people
gaining this exploding medical care system do vote.
Well, we could do like Richard Lamb says, you know, you're old, you're tired, you're having a lot of medical problems, die. You know, cut down on the cost of the system.
That's not exactly what he says.
Well, he does say that the older folks do have an obligation to minimize their draw upon the system.
And maybe that's something that needs to be discussed and discussed very, very carefully, as you brought up about. Because if you do look at the resources that are used for replacing body parts, that could go a long way to provide minimal health care for the young, as far as immunizations, education in nutrition and lifestyle issues.
Yeah.
So that's
but in a country of this wealth, I don't understand why we even have to make that kind of trade-off because of the way we distribute money towards our overall systems. If we put less money in munitions and in other wasteful ventures, you'll have more money for healthcare. But if you don't want to do that, then you get into various forms of triage.
Politically,
and you create different kinds of problems. This gentleman, it's only because we as a polish choose not to put it there.
I wanted to respond to your question when I see a mendicant. I think many of the things that you mentioned, I think perhaps this was a drug addict and he hasn't been able to get himself worked around. Perhaps this is a mentally ill person and this is what he's doing to survive, or she. But I don't usually give them anything because I'm not sure charity is going to do it. And I think that we as a society have chosen to turn our backs on the weakest in our midst, including the mentally ill and the drug addicts. And I mean, drug addicts are weak. They're people who suffered and are suffering and who can be helped and who can be turned around. But it's expensive to do that. However, it's a lot less expensive than putting them in jail three times and you're out.
Sure.
And that's something that every time I hear that, I just get angry. And I think, why doesn't somebody have the courage running for office to stand up and say, let's give these people treatment. Let's give these people medication and case managers, and instead of spending $50,000 a year to keep one of them in a prison, let's help that person to become a productive member of society, because we can do that. We have some knowledge that can help us to do that. But you got to be mad to be a successful politician, it seems like.
Yeah, I see your point.
Yeah.
Good point. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. Some people say, gosh, no. But couple things. Wisconsin presently has, their education system is really great. But we also have a movement within the political world that's trying to privatize it, which sounds crazy, doesn't it? When we're our top ACT through the nation.
Right.
There's a very strong political move to privatize. So there are people who are opposing that.
Hallelujah.
And we have this program called W-2. Contrary to what maybe some people think throughout the country, our politician who is supporting us, not everybody in the state is really supportive of this movement because it has some definite glitches, leaving exactly the most underprivileged, the most unable people in service. As a Christian,
I think you have to say more. I don't think people know much about it.
Oh, okay.
You have to give more details, I think.
Well, one of the things they were talking about were the eliminating of waivers that was putting women who have children out there on the job when their child is 12 weeks old. They could be earning $5 an hour or $6 an hour without benefit of health care, without child care. Child care has become a critical issue for these young children that we're saying that don't vote. their education, to be able to be lifted out of the poverty is incredible. One other thing I've just found out I've been involved with, it's called Transitional Housing, Madison Urban Ministry. By the end of the year, SSI and SSDI recipients will no longer be receiving that. These are people who are receiving assistance due to alcohol, drug-related problems. They would no longer be able to receive some form of assistance, so they would have money. Many of them are mentally ill. Mm-hmm. Many of them are veterans, frankly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we need to be aware to look between the lines of something when you're voting for someone, and get everybody out to vote.
Okay.
And make certain everyone you know is registered. So.
Okay. Yes.
There's so many thoughts going on right now. I see myself as a very pragmatic and practical person, and I believe very much in self-reliance. I come from a working background family like yourself, and one of the things that's taught me was a good word, that work ethic. And I've tried to do the same with my children. And I believe that's where it starts. You can have committees, you can talk about this all you want to, but it starts at home, by example. Nowhere else. Not the government helping you out, anywhere else. You learn it from your parents and grandparents, and you pass it on. And somewhere, we skip that.
Well, I think a good work ethic is very important. And
I'm talking about a mental ethic that says, I can do this. It teaches you to achieve, regardless of which direction you go. You end up being a physicist or a bricklayer, it doesn't matter.
Well, I think you're right there, but I'm not as confident with you that that's enough. I mean, my grandfather was a sharecropper. He lived to be about 80 years old, died a sharecropper, worked his whole life, had a good work ethic. And most of the people who are poor in this country are the working poor. They go to work every day, but they remain poor. And they have a work ethic.
Now,
to say that you need a work ethic to move from sustainability to flourishing, I agree with you. What the one problem I have is that there are a lot of people who have a good work ethic and can't really even make it in terms of sustainability. So what I'm saying is, you're right, on one hand, that you do need a good work ethic. But I'm also saying that we need a society in which, if people and families do have a good work ethic, they can move more rapidly from non-sustainability to sustainability, and perhaps even to flourishing. That's all I'm saying. Okay? And I think a lot of times people feel that people are poor because they have a bad work ethic or other bad habits. And in some cases, of course, that is true. But in some cases, they simply are not positioned in in work that really is remunerative. I had a student, was it last year, who had a master's in economics. Well, I have two earned doctorates, but not in economics. So I was trying to be deferential to this student in terms of his economic analysis until I read in one of his papers that there's no economic exploitation in America. I had to, you know, it stunned me. It actually did. And I'm rarely speechless, but I was that time. Because it made me think, here's a person who has both a college and a graduate degree and is getting another graduate degree. And his view of America is there's no economic exploitation in America. That also sobered me very heavily in terms of what my teaching responsibilities are. But I think a lot of people do believe that in fact, if that all you need to do is to work hard and that everyone who does work hard will make it in America. Whereas I think everyone does need to work hard.
I think that should be the floor that you stand on while you're achieving these other things. Without that drive, personal integrity to drive to succeed, regardless of what you do, you're not going to get here.
No, I agree with you there. I don't have a quarrel with you there.
What I'm saying is that these other things have to be there, but that's not the root of the problem.
Well, let's see, here's where we might have to part a little company. One thing that people have to know about this country is that most of your major inheritance, most of your major wealth in this country is inherited.
Right.
It's not based upon merit or work ethic or anything else. It's based upon the fact that we live in a country in which you can have unlimited accumulation of wealth, and you can transfer it with the payment of some transfer inheritance tax to your progeny. Now, I'm not saying we should dismantle that. Don't get me wrong here. But I'm just saying that's how most very wealthy people are wealthy. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, you will have an innovator, a Disney, a Hayes, a Vince Hayes modem, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, they will come along and they will create new industries and new wealth, but they're more the exception than the rule.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
I disagree.
Well, if you show me the statistics, I'll agree with you.
Well, actually since 1980, half the people who are considered wealthy, the top 5% of the income earners are new in that group.
Yeah, I'm talking about the 0.5%, not 5%. I'm
right.
Talking about the real big one.
But, you know, it isn't cut and dry. It isn't like, here's the super rich and there's more Bill Gates than you think that there are.
Oh, okay. And
but,
and your point is, though?
But, well, my point was that it wasn't. what I wanted to do was support this gentleman here and what he was thinking that the I feel like we're putting the cart before the horse here and saying, well, if we just have more government programs or address this, we'll be able to solve these problems. But the basic problem is that we've lost sight of that personal responsibility and that.
You lead by example, but your life's so shine.
I would agree with you, except I know too many poor people who work very hard and have very good work ethics. And some of them even have some education.
That's a whole different perspective.
But.
It seems like we've lost the focus on the importance of that.
Well, if you're saying to me that some people don't want to work, I'll never argue with you on that.
No.
I think that's true too, but but I'm not sure that's the source of the problem of poverty in this country.
It goes beyond the work. I mean, like you said, there's a lot of people that work hard and don't get out of the hole. But I see a lot of people, a lot of expectation, particularly of the younger generations, where they're looking for somebody else to make their personal decisions or their lifetime decisions or to take responsibility for those decisions.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. I have to think about that. Yes?
I think people are saying a lot of things that are right, they're little pieces. Definitely when I see children coming into the school system that don't come from a stable family home, that haven't been raised with really good moral values or with strong values, that there's, you know, alcoholism, drug dependency in the family. I mean, it's going to be hard. I mean, they're not starting out with some of the basics, and you need those. You need a healthy, you know, emotional, spiritual state to be able to flourish. And then, but I think what some people are saying is that you need more than that. There's got to be, you know, physical, structural opportunities for people who are capable of study and are capable of sitting in a classroom and functioning and learning. And some kids come in and are not capable of even sitting and functioning and learning. That's a big problem. But I wanted to go back to what you had said about when I see poor people, because I'm from Santa Cruz, and Santa Cruz certainly has an interesting reputation, not always very positive. But since the earthquake in 89, I think, is it 89? And when our downtown was destroyed, it's never come back, even though physically it's come back, in terms of a lot of buildings have, you know, been rebuilt. But what has happened, and I don't quite understand it, there's a lot of homeless in Santa Cruz. We do have a homeless shelter there. Some of the cities next to us do not have homeless shelters, and they have a lot of police, and they don't let the poor people hang out on the streets. It's very clean, it's very touristy, it's very different. Santa Cruz has a homeless shelter. We have a lot of homeless people on the street, and a lot of, but it's really a drag to be downtown Santa Cruz now. It's very different than it used to be because there's such intense panhandling. But it's not just the intense panhandling. It's the young people that are panhandling, very young people, 13, 14, you know, 16. Obviously, drug problems, we got the mental illness, but the vibrations are really unfriendly. And you got packs of, you might have 40 or 50 semi-homeless young people just hanging out in the street. And in spite that we've got a lot of new businesses there, people don't really want to hang out and shop because vibrations are not there.
Sure.
I feel very negative towards Santa Cruz now, and I consider myself this sort of liberal person. At the same time, my compassion is very limited, especially when I see young people. I should be very compassionate for them, but when I see young people doing drugs, really kind of wasting away, and not only that, but kind of degrading the environment in the town, you know, I'm thinking, you know, why do we put up with this in Santa Cruz? Why all these other towns, you know, have this heavy police force thing going on and they keep their towns clean? You know, we have this, what, liberal acceptance, and but it's really hard on the business aspect. It's very strange because it's very sad, and I do feel like a lot of these young people did not come from stable homes that the support, you know, single family homes with a lot of pressure on them and support wasn't there. They may be intelligent people, but it's hard. And I do feel negative and critical and not and sounding very conservative these days because it's when it's really young people, and you know they're not all mentally, well, we've got the mental illness. Statistically, a lot of people are mentally ill, but it's very strange. I don't, it's a very strange situation.
These folks aren't old enough to be crazy, huh? I mean, I'm sorry, but I see your point. You know, you see that in Atlanta with the Olympics. You know, I got my PhD in Atlanta, and you know, you see a lot of homeless people, but you know, a lot of Olympics come to town, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, black policemen, because Atlanta's got a fairly good contingency of black policemen, start rounding up a lot of folks who live under highways and in parks and whatever, because the world is coming to town. And, you know, all of a sudden there's this huge concern with homeless, but not really to, you know, either encourage or cajole them into different living, but basically cosmetic.
Hide
you know, it's hide them, but also, you know, we have to have business in Atlanta, you know, and it's got to look good. Cosmetically, it's got to look good. There was a hand over here. Ah, there we are.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the problems is greed, and I think it's at the, I mean, I don't know, you see these salaries published in the paper of heads of companies that make just obscene salaries, and yet companies who are not even doing poor, I mean, they're not doing poorly, maybe their stock went down a little bit, then they downsize, get rid of all these people, and yet their heads of their company are making such, now why can't they make less and give more jobs to people?
Well, because that's not in the nature of capitalism. But now, I'm not saying that capitalism should rule the world either. I mean, and that we can't have forms, in fact we do, with antitrust law. We have fettered that. But I love your example of downsizing because, you know, I share that with my students, most of whom took the position that, you know, all you needed was, again, merit. You can go up and up and up and nothing will ever happen bad to you. Until I began to show them some of the statistics on downsizing of people who they could identify with, who did grow up in the suburbs, who were either technically or college trained and still found themselves to be expendable in the system. And what I began to say to them is, here's people who are just like you, and yet they find themselves on the outside, unemployable. We need to rethink some aspects of what are our obligations together.
And also, I was just going to mention, my mother was in a nursing home, and we paid like almost, our, it was her money, paid almost $4,000 a month. And one of the nursing assistants worked, and they worked very hard, and she had to leave quickly. She had to get right off because she had another job as a nursing assistant in a different nursing home. So, and her mother took care of her baby, and she got to see him on her day off. Now, I think that's working pretty hard.
That's working darn hard. Way in the back, you haven't said anything, and I'd like to have you have the last word, since we're technically out of time, but go ahead.
Oh, okay, well.
No, go ahead.
Make it quick. Just going back to the last couple of comments, including the work ethic, I think it brings us full circle around to the accessibility to education and training, which we need to wake up and realize is now lifelong education and continuous retraining. Because in a market-driven economy for jobs, the only way you can guarantee sustainability, much less flourishing, is to have something to trade that is of value. And something to trade of value means, you know, I might get downsized, but I want to make sure that what I can do is going to be valuable enough that if this company doesn't need it anymore, somebody else will. In a gray economy, if you grew beans and it was a big year for beans, you weren't going to get a very good price with them. If we spend our time and our energy training people to do jobs that anybody can do, well, guess what? They're very vulnerable. We really have a higher degree of need for specialized training, like somebody mentioned over here, as well as the need's never gone away for higher education and a certain number of jobs. But that is what we as people, as workers, trade. And the market will place a value on it. And woe to us if we lose track of the value of what we do to the world around us.
Well, amen to that. But now let's... rather than end on woe, let's just end by saying praise be to God. But thank you. That was a good comment. And thank you for your appreciation. I know there's more to say about this, and I know I haven't figured out a lot of it, but we've run out of time. Thank you again.